The headlines: thousands of demonstrators hit the streets in Brazil's Sao Paulo to demand punishment for supporters of ex-president Jair Bolsonaro. The death toll from a single day of clashes between protesters and police in southern Peru rises to 17. And Russia says new deliveries of Western weapons to Kiev, including French-made armored vehicles, will only deepen the suffering of Ukrainians. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisu Mishahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Brazil's president has condemned as acts of terrorism the Sunday attacks on the presidential palace, the Congress, and the Supreme Court. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva made the remarks after a meeting with the leaders of the Houses of Congress and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. In a joint statement, they denounced what they call terrorist acts and coup-mongering vandalism committed by the rioters. The raids were carried out by thousands of supporters of the former President Jair Bolsonaro. The aim was to overthrow President Lula's government a week after it took office. In response, hundreds of people have held protests in Sao Paulo demanding punishment for the rioters.
Totally absurd. It's the worst moment in our history after the 1964 coup that established the dictatorship. I think everyone was appalled by the images we saw in the National Congress. The fight is now to support the government that was democratically elected, and we are not going to leave the streets.
The raids on Brazil's institutions are being compared with storming of the U.S. Capitol in 2021 by supporters of former U.S. President Donald Trump. But Brazil's communications minister says the attacks in Brasilia were more severe. Authorities have so far arrested at least 1,500 people and have vowed to bring the organizers to justice. Condemnations also continue to pour in. One of the latest came from Venezuela, where the president called the rioters neo-Nazis and denounced their assault on public institutions. Iran's foreign ministry has also expressed concern about the developments in Brazil and called for respect for the rule of law. At least 17 people, including two teenagers, have been killed in the latest round of clashes between anti-government protesters and the police in Peru. The toll makes Monday the deadliest single day of protests since they began a month ago. The violence also left 68 people wounded. The clashes erupted in the southern city of Juliaca. Peru's Human Rights Office has urged the police to abide by international standards in using force. The anti-government rallies resumed last week after a holiday lull and have so far left over 36 people dead. The protesters are calling for early elections, resignation of the new president, and closure of the Congress. They also demand the release of ousted President Pedro Castillo. He was arrested after the removal from office in December. Over 7,000 American nurses in New York have staged a strike and protested harsh work conditions and staffing policies. Striking nurses rallied in two hospitals in the Bronx and Manhattan. They waved signs in support of hiring more nurses and better pay. The walkout forced health centers to move patients and scale back other services. The strike came after authorities failed to reach an agreement with the nurses' representatives. The COVID pandemic has exacerbated nursing shortage in the U.S. Many nurses have left long-standing jobs for higher-paying short-term assignments. Earlier, we talked to our correspondent Colin Campbell for more details regarding the strikes.
Well, the strike was organized by the New York State Nurses Association. This is a group of nurses that have come together that advocate their own interests. And what nurses are saying is that they are stressed out, quite frankly. They are overworked and they are tired. So approximately 7,000 nurses went on strike in New York, and they called the attention for some of the subpar conditions in which they've been forced to work in. What does that include? Well, you have nurses that are caring for several infants at a time, when usually it's regulated that when a baby is born, they are paired up with a nurse, meaning one-to-one, very specialized care. Well, now nurses are saying that they have to attend to 3 to 4 babies at a time. This could mean administering medication, making sure that they're calmed down, making sure their diapers are changed. And as you can imagine, these nurses are working overtime or working much more than they should be working. And they also say that because of the lack of nurses that some New York area hospitals have failed to hire, they are working even more when it comes to emergency room situations. And that could mean subpar care for patients. Instead of someone coming in and getting attentive care right away, they may be delayed. Or maybe a patient who's already been admitted may have delayed medication coming to them because that nurse is busy attending to someone else. So what they're saying is they need more nurses. They want hospitals in the area to hire more people and to make pay more competitive, so more nurses will be attracted to those jobs, and that their jobs, the nurses who are already there, their jobs will be a bit easier and they can do them with a bit more quality.
More news from the U.S. President Joe Biden has visited the nation's southern border to get a firsthand account of the refugee crisis snowballing by the hour. This comes as Biden has just expanded a controversial Trump-era policy which allowed for more deportations of asylum seekers. Rahman Mazahari reports.
United States President Joe Biden has visited the Mexican border for just the first time in his presidency. An estimated 8,000 asylum seekers cross the Texas border every day, with last year breaking records.
Official data showed that the number of undocumented immigrant crossings at the southwest border reached 2.8 million people, breaking the annual record by more than 1 million.
In yet another major expansion of a policy of Donald Trump, which the Democratic Party criticized for years, Biden announced the U.S. will immediately deport even more new arrivals. Biden has also drastically increased the number of deportations from the Trump era. The United States accepts fewer refugees per capita than almost any other Western nation, and the world's wealthiest country refuses to provide adequate resettlement and border services.
Let's not forget that the Biden administration still is running the very same for-profit internment camps on the southern border that are full of immigrants. When Trump was president, there was rightfully a lot of criticism of these policies. These are not just holding cells or whatever. These are basically internment camps where large numbers of immigrants, including families and children, are held.
Rarely discussed in the mainstream media is that U.S. foreign policy has played a major role in the Western Hemisphere's long-running refugee crisis. Instead, both the media and Biden's immigration policy give special priority to asylum seekers leaving socialist-inspired nations, Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua.
Encouraging them to leave these countries that have socialist governments. And then, of course, the U.S. government says, look at these people fleeing so-called communism. It's exactly what the Biden administration's spokespeople have been saying. It's basically, you know, right-wing Cold War-style propaganda. And the reality is that these people are not fleeing. These people are going to the United States because the U.S. is telling them, we're going to give you visas.
2022 saw seemingly the entire West accused of racism due to their privileging of refugees from Ukraine over non-white asylum seekers. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Russia has slammed France and other Western states for their recent decisions to ramp up military support for Kiev, warning that such measures could deepen the suffering of Ukrainians. The Kremlin spokesman has reiterated that Western armed deliveries cannot and will not change anything on the ground. Dmitry Peskov says such moves would not deter Russia from achieving its goals either. Last week, France and Germany announced that they would send light combat vehicles, including tanks, to Kiev to help it fight Russia. Ukraine, which has scored some battlefield successes in the recent months, had asked its Western backers for heavier weapons. Moscow, however, has time and again warned that Western leaders are prolonging the conflict by providing weapons to Ukraine. The British government is slashing by up to 85% the support it will give businesses with their energy bills in the next financial year. Now, the government says that its current level of support is, quote, unsustainably expensive. Under the new program, businesses rather than the government will have to pay the extra costs if energy prices surge. British natural gas prices soared in the second half of 2021 and again after Russia launched its war in Ukraine in February 2022. That, coupled with a record high inflation, has led to a cost of living crisis in Britain, in turn prompting strikes across various public and private sectors. UK's Prince Harry's tell-all memoir has not just given the British public a sneak peek into the inner workings of the monarchy, but also embroiled the royal household in controversy. Harry's bombshell revelations in the book have drawn a backlash from the media, commentators, army veterans, and even the Taliban. Now that, as well, support for the royal family is in decline.
The British royal family may appear to be prim and proper to the public. However, they have faced their fair share of controversies over the years. From the separation of Charles and Diana in 1992, and the famous comment of the late Princess of Wales that there were three of us in this marriage, so it was a bit crowded, to the Megxit when Prince Harry and Meghan Markle stepped down from their royal duties. Now, a few years into the new year, the royals are on the back foot. The Duke of Sussex's tell-all memoir, with its bombshell revelations, has turned into a big challenge for the monarchy. Prior to the official publishing of the book, multiple media outlets reported they had secured copies of Harry's autobiography. Among the jaw-dropping claims is Harry's reported retelling of his scuffle with his brother, Prince William, in 2019, his use of cocaine as a teenager, and killing 25 people in Afghanistan when he was a helicopter pilot in the country. He also said he confronted discrimination and neglect from the royal household from a younger age. While Buckingham Palace has kept silent, Harry's revelations have drawn mixed reactions. Some have denounced Prince Harry's tell-all memoir for putting family arguments out there for the world to see. They say Harry's account will be damaging to the monarchy and undermines the king at a time when he is trying to show the institution is modernizing. Others say they sympathize with the sibling rivalry the prince describes and other elements of his experience. The fact is, the British monarchy is by its very nature hierarchical, and this has led to Harry feeling like his spare part. A former royal biographer has said he is perplexed by Harry's memoirs, saying it contains the kind of revelations you would expect from a B-list celebrity. Meanwhile, the royal analyst and biographer of King Charles, Catherine Mayer, has said Prince Harry's book could be the beginning of the end of the monarchy, given the lack of trust in the state at the moment. She said anger over racism, misogyny, and wealth in the royal family can undermine public consent for a monarchy. Survey results over the years show that younger people are less likely than older people to say that it is important that Britain has a monarchy. Indeed, just 14% of under 35-year-olds take that view compared with 44% of those aged 55 and over. This suggests support for monarchy will decline as today's older generation is replaced by younger Britons.
Prince Harry, in his memoir, acknowledges that he killed 25 people in Afghanistan when serving as a military helicopter pilot after the invasion of that country. Ironically, he stresses that those killings do not embarrass him. The revelation has sparked both condemnation and derision from different groups.
Revelations in Prince Harry's newly published book include the murder of 25 people in Afghanistan while serving with the British Army in the country. The 38-year-old described killing targets as moving chess pieces, noting that he was not ashamed of doing so. High-profile British veterans have criticized Prince Harry and warned the high-profile admission could increase the risk to his personal security. Retired Army veteran Colonel Tim Collins said the prince's kill count talk was crass, and we don't do notches on the rifle butt. Others said Harry had appeared wrongly to dehumanize those he killed by describing them as chess pieces removed from the board. That's while the Taliban have accused the prince of committing war crimes on his military tour in Afghanistan. Abdul Qahar Balkhi, the spokesperson for the Taliban-led Afghan Foreign Affairs Ministry, described the Western occupation of Afghanistan as a horrible moment in human history, saying comments by Harry is a microcosm of the trauma experienced by Afghans at the hands of occupation forces who murdered innocent people without any accountability. Last year, an investigation revealed commandos in the UK's elite Special Air Service Corps killed at least 54 Afghans in suspicious circumstances during a six-month tour of Helmand Province from November 2010 to May 2011, but the military chain of command concealed concerns. The investigation found that unarmed Afghan men were routinely shot dead in cold blood by SAS troops during nighttime raids during the long war in Afghanistan, and weapons were planted on them to justify crimes. In 2001, the US and its close allies, including the UK, invaded Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting Al-Qaeda. The invasion preceded by over two decades of war in Afghanistan and cost 241,000 lives.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Iranian Radio. Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing domestic politics in Saudi Arabia with author and journalist Ali Al-Ahmad. But first, this brief analysis.
The fact that the country is named after the ruling family gives us insight into the basic reality of the so-called nation-state. Indeed, it highlights that Saudi Arabia is actually not a nation-state in the traditional sense, even though it is treated as such in international relations, but rather a family business established by Abdulaziz bin Abdulrahman Ali Saud with the help of the British in the early 20th century in order to destabilize, divide, and conquer the Ottoman Empire, culminating in the establishment of what is today called Saudi Arabia in 1932, when Abdulaziz conquered and annexed the Kingdom of Hejaz, which includes Islam's holiest cities of Mecca and Medina, contrary to the wishes of Abdulaziz's British benefactors. This action by Abdulaziz might have something to do with the fact that American oil companies discovered oil just 2 years prior to this Saudi attack on Hejaz in the Shia-majority eastern Persian Gulf Coast region, which the Saud had conquered and devastated 15 years prior to that. This makes Saudi Arabia the only country in the region whose oil was always directly under U.S. control from the very beginning and never under British control. A matter which bothered the British for years, as shown in later declassified documents from that era. The absolute monarchy of Saudi Arabia has been passed on after the death of Abdulaziz in 1953 until today, from one of his sons to another, from half-brother to half-brother. This being possible because he had so many sons that there are debates about how many he actually sired. The most common figure mentioned being around 50. This is, however, all changing now as his son Salman, the current monarch, has appointed his son Muhammad as the crown prince and heir apparent, trying to establish the monarchy in his own line of descendants and excluding the approximately 5,000 other Saudi princes from the royal succession in perpetuity. Muhammad bin Salman has already shown his family values before becoming king, when he arrested dozens of his most influential cousins and imprisoned them in a luxury hotel until they pledged allegiance and transferred billions of dollars of their wealth to him. Muhammad bin Salman's irrational actions on the international scene, such as beginning the genocidal war on Yemen, kidnapping, murder, and literal butchering of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, or kidnapping, beating, and forced televised resignation of former Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri, have brought more unwanted attention to the rule of the Al Saud in these few years than in all the 70 years prior to that. Prior to Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudis maintained a media policy of not being spoken about in the media, a policy enforced for decades by bribing and buying or, when necessary, threatening, imprisoning and killing journalists, dissidents and media owners around the world. The family rule of the Al Saud is entering uncharted territory as the family business is passing from the brother's generation to the cousin's generation and the attempt to consolidate the monarchy in the Salman line. There has never been a real national feeling in this nation named after a family, with many regions maintaining their distinct identity. Regions such as Hejaz, or the Shia-majority Persian Gulf Coast, or the southern regions of Najran, Asir, and Jizan, which have historically, culturally, and religiously always been part of Yemen, and were part of the regions conquered and annexed by Abdulaziz in the 20th century. It remains to be seen if the next generation of people on the Arabian Peninsula will forego their natural right to self-determination and elected government and passively accept continued absolute monarchy and the concentration of biblical levels of wealth in the hands of the Al Saud family in return for being allowed to celebrate Halloween or to occasionally attend the concerts of scantily dressed female pop singers. And if history is a guide, it is improbable that this tribal family rule dressed up as a nation-state will survive in its current form.
Ali Al-Ahmad, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. You're joining us from Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C. area. And I'm very glad that you accepted our invitation, because we want to talk about Saudi Arabia, a subject which, if you look at the way it's treated in the mainstream media in the West, it's always done in a very bad way. It's done in a way where either they don't talk about Saudi Arabia or they do it in a very caricature way. And I want to, with your permission, I want to focus our conversation on the domestic internal realities that exist in Saudi Arabia, because I believe that this is an area where we have very little information and very little analysis that's been done. And of course, we always try to talk to persons who are from the country that we're talking about. So, alhamdulillah, we have a chance to talk to you about these issues. So, I want to, before we get into the domestic issues, I want to maybe first talk about this thing that I was just talking about and mentioning, which is the idea of talking about Saudi Arabia in the West and in the Western media, and this very suffocating environment that exists because of the influence that the Saudis have in the West on policymakers, on the media, on think tanks, in the education system, in the university. So if you could, very briefly first, tell us a little bit about what you do, which is to talk about Saudi Arabia in an environment that doesn't want to talk about Saudi Arabia.
Definitely. When I finished college and I moved to Washington, my idea is to talk about issues, or to write and speak about issues that people do not speak about either here or in our country. And it was not a very positive experience. The environment in Washington, D.C., when I arrived, was very pro-Saudi, very little sympathy to criticism of Saudi Arabia, because they are our allies. And that is all it takes, no matter how bad they are. And definitely the American policy and the Western policy has been, regardless of what a government be, like Saudi Arabia and other pro or American-backed regimes in our area, no matter what they do, how they behave, it's okay as long as they do what we want. And so I focused on issues of religious freedom in the beginning, mm-hmm. because I wanted to show them how fact that you, for you as a Christian people, you are not allowed to do X, Y, Z. And of course, I added and focused on the issue in general of the religious freedom. Then it moved after September 11 to the idea of terrorism, how Saudi Arabia is involved in terrorism, and it's killing your own people. In both issues, I realized that there is some sympathetic people to hear this message, but the system itself is aware of these issues, and it plays, in fact, a part in Saudi Arabia being an oppressive state that the U.S. Basically sometimes allowed or looked the other way or participated with the Saudi government in these issues regarding terrorism and, you know, sending people and money to Afghanistan and then to Chechnya and to other parts of the world, and even to Iraq and Yemen and other countries. So then, of course, the issue of women, which is easy for the Western mind, it's the same issue, not only on the level of the government, but also on the level of think tanks and also of so-called human rights organization. I recall in 2008, pioneered the idea that women in Saudi Arabia are not allowed to play sports. And I said, you know, Iran is a religious state, is a Muslim state. Exactly. They play sport. Women have federations, and states like Qatar next door, which follows the same religious interpretation of Saudi Arabia, women are allowed to play sports, and even in Yemen. And we had this campaign, which I pioneered. The resistance was very clear. I remember it was Hillary Clinton as a Secretary of State, and I was told that don't ever come back with this idea to the State Department. And it was my way of testing the water, actually,
yes,
to see how would they react, and their reaction was very negative. And this is Hillary Clinton, who calls herself a women's rights champion, and recently she gave an interview and talked about women in Iran, for example. The reality, Western countries, bar none, have used human rights as a weapon against people or against governments they don't like. And they hid and hide and water down the abuses of their allies and friends. And Saudi Arabia is a prime example. Just yesterday, the British Parliament struck a statement by a member of the parliament there that's critical of Saudi Arabia. Because the Saudis said, oh, we don't like it. So, I mean, this is exactly what I call, this is a phenomena in a new study in politics, and this phenomena that I hope to write about one day, I call it the Carter factor, meaning that when a democracy like the United States is now adopting the policies and of a dictatorship that is it is actually supporting and it's actually protecting and it is the reason this dictatorship survives.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I remember former foreign minister, Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, he had a very funny tweet. He used to do some funny tweets. He talked about the B team. He talked about Bolton, bin Salman, bin Zayed, and Bibi. If you're on the B team, you are completely immune from any prosecution for any crime that you might commit against anybody, whether it's in your own country, whether it's attacking Yemen, whatever it is. So I think with what you're saying, Mr. Ahmed, it seems that when it comes to this idea of Saudi Arabia being so vital, as they say, vital for American and Western interests, and as you said, Britain is maybe even worse than the Americans in some ways, they very easily step on their own principles, step on their own claims, and apply it in a very selective way, as you mentioned in the case of Iran versus Saudi Arabia. So that brings me now to the subject which I hope that we can spend most of our conversation on, which is that we have very weak analysis of what happens in Saudi Arabia, which I believe is something that's done on purpose. There aren't really people are not encouraged to sit down and think about Saudi Arabia in a deep way, in a historic way, because that would, as you say, open up so many different problems that then leads to other issues, which is not done. So I want to start this way. Please correct me if I'm wrong. I believe that we are now witnessing a historic time in the history of what's called the third Saudi state, as they say among the historians, which is that since the founding of Saudi Arabia, the third Saudi state, by Abdulaziz, we've had until now with King Salman the ruler being one of the brothers, one of the sons of Abdulaziz, and it's been going on since 1953 for 70 years now almost. One brother or one half-brother passing it on to the next one. And, in a tribal society, that might be something that's maybe, for reasons of trying to keep the family peace, that this might be a smart thing to do. But now we are witnessing that after Salman, we are now going to the generation, which is not. It is the cousins' generation. They are now cousins. And this idea that maybe Ali Salman, that Mohammed bin Salman, is trying to consolidate the rule in his own line, in his own family. And it seems to me that this is not going to go well. It seems to me that if you have 5,000 Saudi princes with different factions and different views and different ways of looking at things, that regardless of what other else is happening in Saudi Arabia with other people and other groups and other movements, the idea that Ali Saud is somehow going to peacefully accept that Mohammed bin Salman is going to consolidate power in his own family seems to me a very naive way of looking at what's going to happen in Saudi Arabia.
Well, this is actually is not as surprising. I wrote about it in 2015. Before even Salman was basically took over. And the idea that there was very clear suggestions in Washington, D.C., among certain American elites that it's not sustainable that the Saudi monarchy continues to kind of have this open succession that gives sort of an unpredictable succession. So where it's to the cousin and then to which cousin and then people fight over it. So what I call is the West, and they have done that in Jordan, for example.
Yes.
They supported and engineered a transition from a horizontal system of transferring of power from brother to brother.
Exactly.
To a completely vertical system where it's father to son.
Mr. Ahmed, let me just explain for our audience that so for decades, the crown prince in Jordan was Hassan, the brother of King Hussein. Yes. And suddenly, a few years or briefly before King Hussein's death, he issued an edict making his son the crown prince and putting the... So I'm sorry, I just wanted to clarify for those of our audience who didn't know. So you're saying that a similar thing is happening in Saudi Arabia?
Yes, in Jordan, just to let you know, because I followed it very closely, and I was at the time in Minnesota, and I knew that King Hussein was dying because I live close to the hospital where he was going to. So I know some of the doctors who actually told me. At the time, we didn't have internet, so I can talk about it. But the idea is, it was 3 weeks. This current ruler in Jordan was 20 days exactly, where he was a crown prince, and he, you know, before. So it was a last-minute change that was pushed by the Americans and the Israelis, and they engineered it, and they chose a person who has never been even a candidate for a political position.
Yeah, let's also mention that Abdullah's mother is British. Well, let's also mention that.
Yes, that's another issue. We can talk about it. There is more stuff, and I wrote about it in 2004. There are more details about Abdullah and his life and so on. So right now the game is to make the Saudi state a vertically, you know, power is transferred vertically from father to son. And just to talk about the think tank world, you know, in Washington, they don't want to hear the voices of the people of that country. And mm-hmm. recently, I spoke to a very senior and seasoned person who is now in charge of one of these famous think tanks. They had a session on Saudi Arabia. No Arab was involved, all Americans,
right,
and from a certain faith. And I sent him a message. He says, this is a form of bigotry when you talk about a country like they are animals and you don't even get anybody from that country to talk. There are people who can speak English from my country and who have PhDs, and they should be part of this discussion. And so they made excuses after excuses, and this is not the first time, and that's intentional, not only in the media but also in the think tank. The media in this country follows the what they call the national security of the United States, for example. The same thing with the BBC, where BBC is a state broadcaster, like Press TV is a state broadcaster. So it's not as independent as they would like us to believe. Unfortunately, they're not. They have agendas, and they want to focus on one thing versus focusing, you know, ignoring important stuff. And that comes with focusing on, for example, certain marginal political prisoners and avoiding to talk, to ignore the most important influential political prisoner, like in our country, Dr. Muhammad Fahad al-Gahtani, who mm-hmm. has a PhD from Indiana, who is basically a national figure. He's like, like a Nelson Mandela. Mm-hmm. But there hasn't been a single article about him, although he has been disappeared for 40 days now after serving 10 years in prison, and he's still not out of prison. So, and that tells you the kind of how the Western media is focusing on the thing that goes along with the policy of the regime, or sometimes of the particular the president.
Well, it seems to me you actually made a good example of Nelson Mandela, because, as you know, for decades they tried to, you know, because they wanted the apartheid South Africa to be on their side in the Cold War, so they marginalized Nelson Mandela, and in the end he won. So, you know, it seems to me that that's why I asked the question. It seems to me that it's kind of a misanalysis of the reality. So, yes, they might say that it's good if there is a consolidation of the rule in Saudi Arabia in the line of Salman. This is, might be something that's good on paper. That sounds good when they're analyzing it as a theoretical matter. But it seems to me the first problem with that is not even, we don't, like I said, we don't even have to go to the other players and other people and other groupings that exist in Saudi Arabia. The Al Saud themselves might not agree to this. It seems to, if you look at what he did, I mean, at the time, it's very famous, everybody knows this. He basically rounded up most of his cousins, you know, locked them up in the Ritz-Carlton and decided to, you know, get money from them and get pledges of allegiance from them. I mean, this is something that it's unprecedented. We don't really have this, even though, you know, the Saudi state is very repressive. But we never had the brothers and brothers, you know, doing these things to each other. But it seems to me he's very okay with, you know, putting his own family and his cousins. And there was even a mentioning, I'm not sure, I don't want to say for sure, but there was reports his mother was not seen for 4 years. People were saying that he might have even, you know, put his mother under house arrest. I mean, he seems to be a very gangster type person, which it seems to me that Al Saud might not accept that. What is your analysis of the situation?
Look, there's two things. You are partially right that other members of the ruling family, and that's natural everywhere, politicians and people who can be rulers and take power, would compete. That's no questions about it. Saudi Arabia is not an immune state or regime for that. But also to state that, oh, this is only the first time. This is not the first time. Mm-hmm. The Saudi states, just like, forget the first and the second. I mean, it has these issues. But this current state, King Abdulaziz, that's something many people who even study the country, especially in the West, who are actually just reading a few papers and then they think they know the country. King Abdulaziz had a brother by the name of Muhammad, and he was a younger brother. And he was the crown prince after him. He was supposed to be the ruler after him. But suddenly Muhammad, you know, he was younger, like, you know, many years younger. And he played an important role in Abdulaziz's wars, a civil war that, you know. But he was dead. And, you know, I later learned from his grandson that he was murdered by Abdulaziz. And then also Abdulaziz murdered the son of his brother. They suffocated the brother in his sleep. You know, they used the slaves at the time, so they had him do it. And then he organized his nephew be killed in the desert by running a car over him. And that time, the entire country had like maybe 10 cars, but suddenly he was run by a car in the desert in a hunting trip.
Right.
So this
is nothing new. If we see this happening during the rule of Mohammed bin Salman, it's basically following his grandfather's pattern.
And King Saud was overthrown by his brothers, and King Faisal was killed by his nephew. With the encouragement of his brothers. So it's these things happen in the Saudi family.
So maybe we can say this, Ali Al-Ahmad, that we will probably see conflict in the future within Al Saud. That this is not such a done deal. Because, you know, Mohammed bin Salman is very young. He's 37 years old. They're hoping, the Americans and the West are hoping that he will have a very long, you know, rule, being their, you know, ally there for the next 50 years. But it seems to me this is a miscalculation of things. Because I remember at that time when he became crown prince, you know, we had very senior U.S. intelligence figures like General Hayden talking about that their favorite candidate is Mohammed bin Naif, that he should
be there. So
it seems to me that even in America, there was different factions in America wanted different people to to be the next Saudi king. And
that's true. CIA and the Democrats, and I'll just give you an example. During the Obama administration, the former head of CIA, John Brennan, mm-hmm. he was, before he became CIA, he was what they call the terrorism czar.
And, yes.
You know, he was working out of the White House. And here comes Mohammed bin Naif. At the time, Mohammed bin Naif was the assistant minister of interior in Saudi Arabia.
Correct.
He's not even a deputy. And he was assistant for one division, which is assistant for security affairs. He flew into D.C. several times, three times, I remember. And he was taken to the White House and met with Obama. No other Saudi officials, no even British official, has that pleasure. The closest country to the United States is even the Israelis at this low level were not brought into
exactly.
the White House to meet the president. But it was very clear that he was a CIA guy. They gave him and they wanted him to be the ruler. But Mohammed bin Salman overthrew him and took power, and they didn't see it coming, honestly.
So who was supporting Mohammed bin Salman in America, in the U.S.?
It was at the time CIA and the Democratic, a lot of Democratic side. That's why there is a lot of talk about Mohammed bin Salman and the CIA mouthpiece, like in some think tanks, called Mohammed bin Salman the epitome of counterterrorism. And I said, epitome of terrorism, you mean? Because he's not he was actually right. the person involved who planned
right.
the suicide bombings on the mosque in Qatif and Dammam.
Right.
It's all, and he exported terrorism to Iraq, and I gave evidence. It's not like I'm just saying it. I gave evidence to it.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Ali Al-Ahmed? The Americans are desperately trying to consolidate the Saudi monarchy into one family, to replace the system of brotherly succession that has been the norm in the last 70 years, but which involves uncertainty and instability at the time of succession. Different factions in Washington had favored different candidates for this project, with the Democrats and the intelligence deep state favoring the now sidelined Mohammed bin Naif, and the neocons and Israelis favoring Mohammed bin Salman. Bin Salman has now arrested bin Naif, and it seems this issue has been settled for the time being, with even once very influential and elder princes such as Bandar bin Sultan now pledging allegiance to bin Salman with bended back, so they won't also end up as permanent guests in luxury hotels. If change is going to happen, it will most likely come from out of the Saudi tribe. Indeed, it seems that with the consolidation of power in one family, and with the mentioned concentration of power in the hands of people from the Najd region, the incentive for Hijazis, Eastern Shias, and Southern Najranis, Jizanis, and Asiris to seek a socio-political future beyond the tribal rule of the Saud family will intensify. It is also cynical and insulting to believe that the younger generation on the Arabian Peninsula will forego self-determination and elected government in return for such gimmicks as allowing Halloween celebrations and pop concerts. As the national liberation of once colonized peoples from around the world is reaching completion in the 21st century, and old feudal, tribal, and colonial structures are increasingly dissolving, there is no good reason why the people of the Arabian Peninsula should be an exception to this important historic process. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time, on Insight.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned. In the religion of Islam and its narrations, the body of a woman is considered delicate and fine. Therefore, the works that are on the shoulders of the women must be delicate too. We must not put heavy responsibilities on the shoulders of a woman. Accordingly, in the religion of Islam, a woman is not obliged to pay the alimony or provide sustenance for other members when a man is present. In better words, a woman is not the breadwinner of a house. Conversely, in Islam, a man must work outside the house to earn the money, and the difficult works are on his shoulders. Therefore, the person who must take care of the financial affairs of a house is a man. However, unfortunately, in today's world, we see that women are working outside and the man stays at home to take care of the children. There must be balance in the lifestyle of a family. Both men and women have specific responsibilities to take care of. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.